Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A20-1243, Itasca County versus Itasca County Employees Association. This oral argument is being held on the Zoom platform in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The same procedural rules apply to our Zoom oral arguments as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The oral argument is being recorded today. No other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. I should also mention that there is a clock in one of the rectangles in your grid view that shows the time. The marshal will be keeping the time. And if you have any issues seeing that, let me know, but hopefully it's visible to you. When you start your oral argument, I'll ask that you identify yourself and the party you represent. So counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Jane Poole, and I represent the appellant, the Itasca County Employees Association. This case began as a run-of-the-mill grievance. It was a dispute over the interpretation of the terms of a labor contract. But it's become a case that could destabilize labor relations between public employers and public employees in Minnesota. This is a case about procedure. It's the obligation to follow the process set by the Minnesota legislature when a public employer seeks to change the terms and conditions of employment required by a labor agreement. Under the Minnesota Public Employment Labor Relations Act, or PELRA, the legislatures recognize that unresolved disputes between public employers and public employees are injurious to the public, as well as the parties. And it's the legislature that's declared that it's the express public policy of this state to have a process and procedure for resolving labor disputes. And for groups of essential employees, like the appellant in this case, that process includes the compulsory binding arbitration of grievances, contracts that remain in effect and enforceable post-expiration and until a successor agreement is reached. And because essential employees cannot strike, agreements are not reached until there's either a voluntary contract resolution or contract in terms are imposed upon the parties via interest arbitration. The district court vacated the party's grievance arbitration award and related remedial arbitration award under the Minnesota Uniform Arbitration Act on the grounds that the respondent met the extraordinarily high burden of proving that the arbitrator clearly exceeded her powers. That decision was wrong on 2 points, and I will address each issue separately today. First, the district court erred in finding that the appellant's grievance was moot, and such a determination must be reversed or it would lead to instability in labor relations. And second, the district court erred in re-examining the merits of the grievance and the remedy awarded. And the court's decision to vacate the award based on its review of the merits is a gross deviation of the standard of review, and it must be reversed. With regard to the issue of mootness, the standard of review that this court applies is a de novo review. It is a question of justiciability and arbitrability, and therefore it's reviewed de novo. The appellant in this case filed a grievance over the respondent's elimination of two health insurance plans and a change to a pharmacy network benefit that went into effect on January 1 of 2019, 1 day after the labor agreement expired. The district court found that the grievance was arbitrable, but that it became moot because an interest arbitration award was issued on November 3rd of 2019. And that award set the terms of the successor agreement, which went into effect on January 1, 2019.
Ms. Poole, I'm just going to stop you there. Were the issues in the grievance arbitration and the interest arbitration identical in every respect?
No, the issues were quite different. In fact, the issue in the grievance arbitration was, to kind of be succinct about it, was the labor contract violated? Were the terms of that labor contract violated? Or to put it another way, was there something in the labor contract that authorized the respondent to eliminate those health insurance plans? And if so, if the labor contract was violated, what was the remedy? But the issue in the interest arbitration award is quite different. The issue before the arbitrator in that matter is not whether the contract was violated. It doesn't require any interpretation of the terms of the labor agreement. The question for the arbitrator is, what should be the terms of the successor labor agreement? And so not only are the issues separate, but the remedy or the award imposed is quite different.
So is there any question or issue whether what the county did with respect to changing the health coverage from the previous contract was permissible under the later contract when the interest arbitration was finally completed? Does that contract allow what actually happened?
Well, no. I mean, the issue before the labor arbitrator was, did the contract that was in effect at the time the county took that action allow them to take that action? And the answer to that is...
Right, but what I'm asking is, when the interest arbitration was completed, it addressed health insurance coverage. Is correct. What happened in January of, I guess it's 2019, is that a violation of the new contract with the provisions resolved in the interest arbitration?
Well, I don't think that is technically pertinent, because you have to keep in mind, Your Honor, that the not only PELRA, but the terms of the party's labor contract requires the contract that was in effect at throughout 2019 to remain in effect and be enforceable. And so what we're talking about is, you know, throughout 2019, the terms of the prior contract remained in effect and enforceable. And under that contract, the respondent violated the terms of that agreement.
When did they cease to be enforceable? Now, make sure I understand what you're saying. There was a contract that expired on December 31st. And the allegation is, and I don't know if there's even any dispute, that what was actually occurring in January wasn't consistent with the prior contract, because the prior contract required more health insurance options than were available in January.
Correct.
When did that cease to be the requirement? When did the requirement change from 4 to 2, or whatever the actual changes were?
Sure. I'll refer you back to PELRA. PELRA's requirements that are set forth by the legislature. And PELRA requires under 179A.20 subdivision 6 that contracts remain in effect. So under PELRA, the terms of an existing contract shall continue in effect and shall be enforceable upon both parties until the terms of a successor contract are reached for essential employees. And so it's my position that that contract remained in effect and enforceable until the date of the interest arbitration award, which was November 3rd of 2019.
So then when the arbitrator actually issued that award, the arbitrator said that it was effective beginning on January 1st.
Correct. The successor agreement always follows the prior contract.
Is your position then that the arbitrator could not do that? The arbitrator had to say that the effective date of the contract was the date in November when the award was issued?
No, Your Honor, my position is that the awards can be read in harmony. The labor arbitrator in the grievance matter issued an award that remedied what she found to be a violation of the labor contract up to the date of the interest arbitration award. And we're not, they can be read in harmony, because there's not a remedy that puts the county's obligations at odds with what the successor labor agreement requires.
I'm trying to understand the district court's mootness conclusion, though. If the later agreement allowed what is actually happening now and what was happening in January. And that contract was in effect on January. Doesn't it change what was legally permitted beginning on January 1st?
No, Your Honor, and that's because of the unique nature of labor contracts in the state of Minnesota. This contract is different than any contract that you'd have, because PELRA mandates that labor agreement remains in effect and enforceable upon both parties until the terms are changed. So what you would be setting up here, if this interest award can moot out a grievance, you're setting up a circumstance in which compulsory binding arbitration required by PELRA and PELRA's requirements that contracts remain in effect and enforceable post-expiration, it would render that provision of PELRA ineffective. You wouldn't be able to...
If that's correct, why doesn't that mean that the arbitrator didn't have authority to make the interest arbitration award effective as of January 1st?
Because they, like I was stating previously, that the two awards can still be read in harmony. There's nothing in the...
So one is an exception to the other, you mean? I mean, the contract is in effect as of January 1st, except with respect to the issues in the grievance arbitration?
No, what I'm saying is that she found there was a violation of the labor contract and that the county should have kept those two health insurance plans that were eliminated in place up until the interest award allowed them to be changed. And there, because the interest award allows those plans to be changed, there's no disharmony in the county's requirements. It's not as if the grievance award mandated those plans be put back in place, but the interest award eliminated them. The grievance award said the county was wrong, but awarded a remedy that's purely a dollar damages amount. That's not an impossible remedy or something that's inconsistent with the obligations under the interest award.
I think Ms. Poole, just following up, is the interest award relevant to the determination of the grievance?
No, not really. I mean, let's hypothesize that the interest award was issued some date later than it was, you know, if these matters weren't heard together. So this arbitrator resolved a grievance and issued this award and frankly, just a damages, pure dollar damages remedy. And the interest award came some months later. You can see how the timing of these matters could lead to great instability between the parties of not knowing, you know, to what extent they could enforce a clearly valid and arbitrable grievance matter.
Can I just jump in? I know you want to move on. And I think clearly we want to talk about mootness. I just have another question regarding the mootness, and that is, did anything preclude the arbitrator from having the interest award commence in November? Was the arbitrator legally required to backdate the interest award to January?
I don't know that she was legally required to do so, but I don't know that I've ever seen a gap between a labor contract's end date and the beginning of a successor labor agreement. That's pretty common in labor relations. But in the short amount of time I have left to talk on the issue of mootness, I do want to bring your attention to sort of the seminal mootness case in Minnesota. And I think it you know, bears on the issues we're talking about today, and that is the case of Minnegasco. In Minnegasco, they appealed a Public Utilities Commission rate order from 1993. And while their appeal of that rate order was pending and processing, the Public Utilities Commission issued a superseding rate order in 1995. Minnegasco's appeal of the 1993 rate order didn't make it up to the Minnesota Supreme Court until 1997. And the argument there, of course, was similar to the argument here, which is, well, this rate order has been superseded and it's now moot because there's a new rate order in place. But the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the matter was not moot, that Minnegasco clearly retained a viable controversy of whether it could recover lost revenue caused by the 1993 rate case, even though that rate order had been clearly superseded. And part of the court's rationale in that case was that if
if the case was moot because the 1993 rate order had been extinguished, that Minnegasco would be left with no remedy, that they, that this would create an inequity because they could either choose to appeal this rate case or request a new rate order, which would moot out their appeal. And sort of a Hobson's choice for Minnegasco as to how to proceed if the case was found to be moot. And I think that's applicable here. Here we have a statutory structure in place for how the parties are to change the terms of a labor contract and how the parties must submit to compulsory binding arbitration. And to hold that a successor contract moots a grievance would create an inequity and a Hobson's choice for labor unions as to whether to grieve a matter or continue with labor negotiations. And I think for those reasons and the public purpose behind PELRA, this matter should not be found to be moot. So we can preserve the party's stability in labor relations in this state. In sum, Your Honors, the respondent did not meet its heavy burden of proving that the arbitrator clearly exceeded her powers within the meaning of the Minnesota Uniform Arbitration Act. We're asking the district court's order be reversed and remanded with instructions to confirm the awards.
Thank you. Counsel, for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Moreau. I am here representing the respondent, Itasca County. We're here today because the county filed a motion to vacate the arbitration awards for the grievance arbitration and for the resulting damages award. And the legislature specifically granted the courts the authority to review arbitration awards and in fact mandated that upon establishment of one or more enumerated grounds in Minnesota Statute 572B.23, that the court shall vacate the award. One of these grounds is whether the arbitrator exceeded her authority. And that's been construed under the case law as a manifest disregard of the party's contract of dispensing the arbitrator's own brand of industrial justice or issuing an award that the arbitrator personally believed was a just result. While there is a preference and a presumption for the finality and validity of arbitration awards, the fact remains that the arbitrator does not have carte blanche, and that is why the legislature granted the courts the authority to review arbitration awards and to do so on a de novo basis. This is especially important in cases such as this one. This case exemplifies the purpose of the court's review function of arbitration awards. Here we have an arbitrator who ignored the party's contract, who ignored the facts presented before her. As required under the contract between the parties, the arbitrator was to make a determination based upon the contract and the facts presented. And the arbitrator even ignored some of her own findings here in reaching a result that was manifestly in disregard of the party's contract and the facts. There can only be one conclusion reached that the arbitrator issued her awards based on her own personal view of what would be a just result. And under Minnesota statute and interpreting case law, this award was properly vacated and this court should affirm the district court's decision. Now, the awards are properly vacated for two primary reasons. First, the arbitrator here, she decided a grievance over which she had no jurisdiction because it was moot. And second, the arbitrator exceeded her authority in determining the awards at all and in ordering a remedial damages. Regarding mootness here, mootness is a jurisdictional doctrine. And counsel for the association is emphasized an instability that could happen if this court were to affirm the district court's decision on mootness and to vacate the awards here. However, there would be an instability if these moot grievances were allowed to move forward. Mootness is jurisdictional. There's always an element of unfairness if an action is dismissed because it is moot. There are recognized exceptions to the mootness doctrine in Minnesota. Fairness and policy is not one of them. And also it is important to recognize under PELRA, there are a grievance arbitration and an unfair labor practice charge, which is what it appears the association is trying to pursue here. They're distinct and under separate statutes within the PELRA framework. Here, we had only a grievance here, and the grievance is what was rendered moot because the arbitrator issued her interest award, as the court here appears to recognize, making the successor contract effective January 1 of 2019, the day after the prior agreement expired. The arbitrator herself identified the remedial period to be between the date the prior agreement expired and the date the successor agreement took effect. There is no remedial period here, and for the arbitrator to exercise jurisdiction over this grievance, it was moot, and that is a clear error, and therefore the award should be vacated.
Ms. Moreau, can you address Ms. Poole's argument that the grievance, the issue in the grievance is different than the issue that the district, or that, excuse me, that the arbitrator addressed in the interest award? And one has to do with a violation of the contract, and the grievance has to do with the violation of an existing contract, and the interest award has to do with determining health insurance plans going forward in a new contract.
I don't disagree that a grievance and interest arbitrations are different. They do perform different functions. But the issue we have here is, due to the circumstances that occurred in this case, the issue of what health insurance plan should become effective on January 1st, 2019 was the same in both of these arbitrations. And in fact, one arbitration hearing was conducted for both arbitrations. So they weren't even conducted separately here. They were treated within the same framework.
And so how does the interest award moot out the grievance then?
Interest award moots out the grievance because if you look at the language of the grievance of what the union here filed, they filed a grievance asserting that the county violated the party's agreement by unilaterally eliminating certain health insurance plans effective January 1st, 2019. In the interest award, the issue was what insurance plans should become effective for the county employees and for the association effective January 1st, 2019. So while the issues are phrased slightly differently, they're not phrased identically, the crux of the issues is the same. What insurance plans should be effective January 1st, 2019? Now, in the interest award, if the arbitrator had determined that the association's proposed insurance plan should take effect, then we perhaps could have a damages issue or a grievance issue here. But the problem we have here is we have two awards that cannot be read in harmony. We have one award in the interest arbitration where the arbitrator recognized the county's actions, recognized the county's efforts in implementing health insurance effective January 1st, 2019. Found that county did not act with unclean hands in treating all of its other unions, I believe there's 10 or 11 others at the time, treated everybody the same here, yet determined in the grievance award that there was such a violation that would justify damages in the six figures. That is inconsistency we have here, especially given that there is no remedial period available due to the interest award taking effect, or interest award determining that the successor agreement takes effect January 1st, 2019. I think the applicable case here too is the Education Minnesota Greenway versus ISD number 316. In this case, this case involved a grievance and an unfair labor practice charge that was filed in district court. The unfair labor practice charge was what was allowed to move forward after the parties reached a successor agreement and the grievance was dismissed. And in that case, the court determined whether a case is moot, you look at the relief demanded with the circumstances of the case at the time of the decision. Here, at the time the grievance was decided, the interest award was also decided, making that health plan effective January 1st, 2019, which is exactly what the union had grieved. And along those lines, as I reflected before, an unfair labor practice and a grievance, they are two separate items, two separate remedies, if you will, under the PELRA statute. The association here did not bring such a charge, although another union did initially, and it was resolved. And that is why the union and the Greenway matter was allowed to move forward with its unfair labor practice because there's different remedies involved there, such as injunctive relief, that are not present within a grievance.
So is what you're saying that an alternative procedural path would have been to pursue the interest arbitration, assume that turned out the way that it in fact turned out, the arbitrator says the two plans is permissible, that's part of the contract, effective January 1st, but then to deal separately with the fact that the county did this unilaterally, the way to get at that issue would be to bring an unfair labor practice procedure?
Yes, Your Honor, that is absolutely a remedy that the union had here. And in fact, one of the county's unions did commence an unfair labor practice charge that was ultimately resolved before it went very far. So that is a remedy available to the union here, the association here, and it chose not to pursue it, which is certainly its right to determine which remedy to pursue. But the fact remains here, the remedy it pursued here became moot because of the interest award. And although
an unfair labor practice charge would not have been moot, is your point?
Under the case law, it appears that it may not have been. Obviously, we don't know because a charge was not filed here in district court. But under the Greenway case, it certainly suggests that even with a grievance being resolved or successor agreement being reached, there still could be remedies available under the unfair labor practice charge under the statute, such as injunctive relief, which is not a remedy available in a grievance award. If Your Honors don't have any other questions on the mootness argument, I do want to just conclude that by saying that the arbitrator exceeded her authority in exercising jurisdiction over this grievance, which was moot, and that is why it was properly vacated here. For the second reason why these awards were properly vacated, the arbitrator exceeded her authority in several ways in issuing the award for the grievance and for the ensuing damages award. Only one ground is necessary to justify the vacation of these awards. And there are four grounds listed in the district court order as for the arbitrator exceeding her authority. And the focus here should be, again, whether the arbitrator exercised a manifest disregard of the party's contract. Under the party's contract here, in Article 12, the contract required the arbitrator to base her decision on the express terms of the agreement and to the facts presented before her. Here we have in both the grievance and the damages or remedial awards, the arbitrator did not base her decision upon the terms of the agreement and upon the facts presented. I want to focus here, as I mentioned, there are four areas here, but I want to focus my time here on the fact that in the grievance award, in the grievance arbitration, there is a two-part issue, and Ms. Poole referenced that in her argument too. One is essentially, was there a violation of the contract? And then two, if so, what is the appropriate remedy? In this case, the arbitrator clearly erred by issuing the remedy she issued here, issuing a remedy at all due to the fact that the remedial period had been essentially wiped out or mooted, as previously argued, because of the lack of any remedial period between end of the prior agreement and the beginning of the successor agreement. I'm going to point the court's attention to the fact that the arbitrator here found that there was a violation of the party's agreement in terms of the life insurance issue. There was an issue raised in the grievance as well that the county violated the terms of the agreement by unilaterally changing the life insurance benefits, which was also again an issue addressed in interest arbitration. However, the arbitrator found that for a grievance, it's a question of remedy. And for the life insurance issue under the grievance, the arbitrator found that there's no evidence presented to justify an award of damages. So therefore no damages was awarded. And that is the same thing we have here with the health insurance piece of it. There were no damages. Based on the evidence presented to the arbitrator and based upon the terms of the contract, there was simply no basis for the arbitrator to award the damages here. Instead, what she did was the arbitrator placed sole reliance upon these two cases stemming from Independent School District 197. There was a court case and there was an arbitration. Both stemmed from the same employer making the same decision. We just had two different unions exploring their different avenues for relief. So it was really one decision. And in that case, the facts were completely distinguished here. I covered those thoroughly in my brief, and the fact that that employer there took no action to keep their unions informed, gave no notice, and changed unilaterally the health plans, which is not a situation we have here. They also had expert testimony present actuarial evidence as to why the premium differential was a proper measure of damages. We had none of that here. So what the arbitrator did was, by ignoring the terms of the contract and the facts.
Ms. Moreau, I'm sorry to interrupt. So I have a question. Is your mootness argument more an issue related to damages? I mean, aren't you really not disputing that the grievance was valid, but because interest arbitration resulted in a backdated award, there simply aren't any damages?
I believe, Your Honor, that the county raised a mootness issue in the grievance arbitration out of concern that this would happen, because the county's position at the time was that by going to interest arbitration that would determine the successor agreement, there was no period, again, no remedial period. So to answer your question, Your Honor, I think the county's concerns were realized through the award of the interest arbitration here, where the arbitrator determined there was no remedial period. So I guess to answer your question, it's the county's position that it goes both ways. One, it does refer to jurisdiction, whether the arbitrator could issue the award, and also it goes to negate any remedy here. And I see I'm out of time here, so I would just respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moreau. Ms. Poole, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I first want to address a statement from the respondent's counsel at the top of her argument that a review of an arbitration award is de novo. I found that surprising, because it's black letter law for the past 60 years that the review of an arbitration award on the merits is extremely narrow.
I thought she said that review of the mootness issue was de novo.
Okay, but that would be my error in listening. I heard that the review was de novo, and I just want to make clear that there's really two separate standards of review for this court to consider. The mootness issue is de novo. The review on the merits is extremely narrow scope of review, as I stated, long established by the U.S. Supreme Court. Second, I want to respond to your question about a unfair labor practice charge being an alternative path or remedy available to a labor union. And I want to make clear that the grievance arbitration process and the unfair labor practice process in this state are two distinct methods to seek to resolve labor disputes. The grievance arbitration process is in place for a labor arbitrator to resolve disputes over the interpretation of the terms of a labor contract. Again, going back to the United States Supreme Court from the last 60 years, it's black letter law that the labor arbitrator is the reader of the party's contract. And so to say that a dispute over interpretation of contract terms is appropriately resolved in an unfair labor practice claim that's litigated in district court sort of turns that long-held standard on its head. It's in fact a labor arbitrator that's required to be the reader of the contract. And you can see in the record, there's a labor arbitration award related to the Independent School District, I think 97 litigation, in which the district court, seeing that there was a question over the interpretation of a labor contract, sent the matter to a labor arbitrator for a labor arbitrator's resolution. So an issue that initiated as an unfair labor practice claim was sent back to a labor arbitrator for her resolution of that matter. So a ULP charge, an unfair labor practice charge, is not a viable alternative path. The standards are different, and the remedies are different. And if you look at the Greenway case that was held not to be moot by this court, it's interesting that case wasn't moot, because I would argue it was its posture was even more moot, if that's a term I can use. The remedy that was sought in the Greenway case was declaratory judgment that an unfair labor practice was committed and injunctive relief. But by the time that case made it before the court, the underlying contract had already been resolved. And so that seemed to be a case in which a remedy sort of would be ineffective because the parties had resolved their labor contract and injunctive relief to force the public employer to negotiate in good faith did in fact appear to be moot. And that's a different setup than what we have here. Here we have under PELRA a requirement that disputes over interpretation of the terms of a contract must be submitted to compulsory binding arbitration. And respondent and the district court ignore the clear requirement under PELRA that labor contracts shall remain in effect and shall remain enforceable even post-expiration. So there's this odd period between the expiration of agreement and the terms of a new agreement being set either voluntarily or through interest arbitration, but that contract remains in effect and the requirement that the parties submit to compulsory binding arbitration remains in effect. And to say that the parties can get no remedy for that interim period because the successor agreement moots that out, sort of moots out that requirement of PELRA. And so for those reasons, we would ask that this court reverse the district court order and affirm the arbitration awards.
Thank you. Thank you to the parties for your helpful arguments and your helpful briefs. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
That concludes.